Welcome to our podcast, Psychiatric Services, From Pages to Practice. In this podcast, we highlight new researcher columns published this month in the journal Psychiatric Services. I'm Lisa Dixon, editor of Psychiatric Services, and I'm here with podcast editor and my co-host, Josh Berezin. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Lisa.
Today, always there's suspense. Is it going to be the three articles? No. It's going to be a single interview about a really cool article on shared decision making that was recently published in the journal.
I think it's a good conversation, and we hope you guys enjoy it. So let's go. Today, we're very lucky to have Dr. Molly Finnerty, who is a research associate professor in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at NYU Langone Medical Center. And she's here to talk with us about her article, Use of a Web-Based Shared Decision-Making Program, Impact on Ongoing Treatment Engagement and Antipsychotic Adherence. So, Molly, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you because Lisa and I, when we were reviewing articles, this one really popped up to us as one that sort of captured a lot of things that we talk about a lot on the podcast. Shared decision making, peers, health information technology. But before we go any further, I think it would be helpful if you can just give like a very brief description of what you were looking at in the study, and then we'll go into some more details.
Sure. So in this study, we implemented a web-based shared decision-making tool developed by Pat Deegan called Common Ground in 12 different specialty mental health clinics. And we were interested in understanding what the impact of use of this program was on treatment engagement. So did the individuals who, you know, used the application, were they more engaged in treatment as evidenced by coming to appointments, by remaining in treatment? And also for the individuals with schizophrenia, were they more engaged in taking their medications? In other words, was their medication adherence higher?
And so how did you get interested? Why study this topic? Why is this something that's important for you?
So my career has really been dedicated to trying to take health information data, and often like large health information databases, and integrating them to support decision making, you know, on the part of at the state level, at a county level, at the level of a large health system network, for the individual clinician as well as consumers and families. So it's really how can we help everyone be on the same page about what has been the treatment to date? What might be recommended if we had all that data at our fingertips about what has been offered in the past? How is it working? And what might we do better in the future?
Hey, Molly,
treatment?
Is this like big data? Is this what we call big data? I keep reading about big data. Do you work with big data?
I do, Lisa. I do. I'm dedicated to big data.
Okay.
And so, you know, to me, the value is, and I can tell you how I got interested in big data. So when I was a resident, my training at Columbia, I had a patient who had bipolar disorder, and she was 7 months pregnant, and she had diabetes that was poorly controlled, and her bipolar disorder was starting to escalate. And she wasn't able to tell me what medication she was on now. She was able to tell me that maybe her doctor had switched her recently because of her pregnancy, but she wasn't able to tell me what she had been on in the past. And during the first week that she was there, she rapidly became one of the sickest clients I'd ever had to, you know, worked with. You know, she was in 4-point restraints. It was hard to even keep her fed. It was heartbreaking and challenging. And it wasn't until we got the medical record, you know, like 2 weeks later or something, that it became completely clear that she'd only ever responded to one medication. And if you saw all the history of her hospitalizations, you'd see they try one medication, they try another medication, and finally they would try Thorazine. And, you know, you have to think to yourself, how many medications would you try before you tried Thorazine? And within days, she'd be fine. And so without that information, we tried a lot of medications at high doses benzodiazepines, antipsychotics, mood stabilizers. We were trying a lot of medications in a pregnant woman, and we're finally advancing to ECT before we got the medical record, and it's like, okay.
So if only you had had access to that data on day one or day minus
right
one.
at the point of intake. Mm-hmm. And then I learned that this data existed in databases. Now I know at the time, this is, going back 20 years, that was like, are you kidding me? We have this data sitting in these massive databases going back 20 years, 30 years of treatment history for our clients. And who gets to see that data? So that data is typically used to maybe decide how many drugs you need to purchase in your hospital, because you look at how many you've used. You use it to manage, you use it to understand costs, you use it for billing, you use it for many types of purposes. But it's only recently, relatively, that we've begun to use these massive databases to support clinical care.
So fast forward to now, from that case in residency, and you've really helped to create some big data resources. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what Psyches is, because the paper that you published is really embedded in Psyches.
So the Psychiatric Services and Clinical Knowledge Enhancement System, or we call Psyches, is a web-based platform that can be used by multiple levels of users, from state health agencies to counties to hospital systems, all the way down to individual clinicians, patients, and families. And the idea is that each would get access to the data that they need to make the kinds of decisions that they need to make. And so one of the very early things we were concerned about is, how do consumers feel about this? Yes, they have concerns about making sure that this data is released, with their consent and that security is attended to. But more importantly, they wanted the people taking care of them to have the best data. And I think all of us can reflect on times that we've received care and the time you had that infection a year and a half ago, what was the antibiotic used? Like, can we even recall it? Or, sure, any medication we're on chronically we can name. But, many of us would have trouble reconstructing our medical history, even as physicians. So imagine our patients that have multiple medical conditions and multiple health concerns and multiple medications that have been tried over time. And all of that would give us important information. So the consumer said, we really want people to have that information. And also they said, and we really want to have it ourselves. And so beginning to think about how to get that data to them, and also to address a really important gap, which is their data, the data on their experience, their knowledge, their ratings of their own progress. That's the really critical gap in the data that we need to manage care. And I had the good fortune, about 10 years ago, to hear Pat Deegan speak on the program that she had developed called Common Ground. And there's some times in our careers where we hear someone speak and it changes the trajectory of our career. And Pat was such a person for me.
She's changed the trajectories of many people. So you're not alone with having been greatly influenced by her. She's remarkable.
So she's a person who developed this, the Common Ground application, and has implemented it in many states across the country. And it is designed to support shared decision making. But I think it does a lot more than that, that the program that she has put together around this application is a lot richer and includes many components. So one of them is that it's peer supported. And so many mental health clinics work with peers, but this really gives them a role, a sort of a front and center role, and integrates them into medication visits. So a peer greets a client in the waiting room, asks if they need assistance logging into the application, asks them if they need assistance entering their data or interpreting the report that is generated by the data that they enter. And then the report that is designed to rate what that person's experience is of their recovery. You know, what are their treatment concerns? What is their progress? And what's been going on? You know, have they been taking their medications? You know, are there other issues that have come up? Are there treatment concerns they may have? So it really tries to address, you know, in some ways we like to think of it as like, you know, what's been going on? You know, how am I doing? What am I concerned about? And what are my preferences?
So just getting back to the study and to kind of summarize. So a client will walk into one of these 12 clinics that you've implemented this Common Ground intervention in, and they will meet with a peer while they're waiting for their appointment. They will interact with the program and they'll get a printout that they can use to then go into their psychiatric visit. And it's a platform to have a shared decision-making discussion with their treatment provider. Does that sound right so far?
Yes.
And yep. The study was looking to see
what's on the printout, though? What's on the printout, Molly?
So after the individual goes through these series of questions, and it's at their experiences, they're getting asked one question at a time. It's sort of touchscreen navigation. You know, they rate questions on, you know, have they been using their wellness activities? Have they been taking their medications? How would they rate a series of symptoms and things like that? What are their treatment concerns? They get to indicate if they have concerns about medication or side effects that are bothering them. And then we've added, what are your priorities for the day? Embedded in those questions are things like a PHQ-2 or a PHQ-3. And if it's positive, you get more questions. The other thing that we've embedded in these questions is we scan, for those with Medicaid data, we scan their Medicaid data and we look for what we call quality opportunities. So if we see that this is an individual who has, say, diabetes, but we don't see that they've been getting follow-up care for that, we might ask a question about that. Then all of that is summarized for the physician. So it's printed out. They can review it with a peer to talk it through to make sure they understand what it's saying. It's like, and it also plots their progress over time. So they can look at things like, oh, look, you know, this is, you know, looks like I'm not sleeping as well. And it also looks like my mood is getting worse. And maybe there's a relationship between those things I hadn't noticed before. So it helps them to see how they're doing on these different symptoms and reflect on them over time, you know, compared to the other times that they had entered data. And they can do that reflection with the assistance of a peer.
And then what's the hope for the interaction that they're going to have? So they're going to bring in this printout into their appointment. And what's the hope that the printout is going to, and the experience of having gone through this with the peer, how is that going to change the interaction that they have with their provider?
So in the model visit, the person is coming into their visit with their report. It's like they're saying, you know, here's my report. And that the session may begin, you know, hi, how are you doing? Have a seat. Let's take a look at this together. And, you know, they can scan it to look for changes, to look for events, for look for concerns that the individual wants to highlight, that it can be used as a new source of information to guide treatment or make clinical decisions. And in shared decision-making, it's based on this premise that both the physician is bringing in information about their own expertise and treatments, and while the patient is bringing in their expertise on themselves. You know, how am I doing and what are my priorities? And this is a way to help them summarize that and to use as a foundation for making clinical decisions. And I think another interesting idea is, to what extent is this practice of preparing for sessions for clients and being reflective about their treatment and progress, even if the physician doesn't fully engage in the shared decision-making process, is that helpful in and of itself?
Right. So, and does having that just walking into a waiting room and having an interaction with a peer, does that in itself change the trajectory of either what's happening in the appointment, but also does it just change their whole view of treatment in general?
So I want to go over the results of the study.
Oh, Lisa, but we're having such a good time talking about the background. So Molly, maybe you could give us the key findings.
Okay. So in this study, we used a propensity match control group to look at the impact of use of this Common Ground application on our two outcomes, on ongoing engagement in treatment, and for those with schizophrenia, adherence to antipsychotic medications. What we found is that at baseline, that both groups had about eight of the previous 12 months prior to their first use of Common Ground, and for the control group, it was prior to a randomly selected visit among their visits, had approximately 8 months of the previous 12 where they had had a mental health visit of some kind. And that on follow-up, what we found is that there was a significant increase to about 8.5 for those that became Common Ground users, and a significant decrease, interestingly, to about 7 for those who did not in the following 12 months. So that it's, you know, I would say it's a modest difference, but a significant one. And then for the subgroup that had schizophrenia, the medication possession ratio was 0.71 for the control and 0.73 for the intervention group, but no significant difference. And although there was no change in the in the control group in medication possession ratio on follow-up.
Which is the percentage of months that they have medications, correct?
Yeah, the way you can calculate the medication possession ratio is you look, you know, over the course of the year, how many days supply did they have for their antipsychotic? So you can say out of the 365 days in the year, how many days did they have any prescriptions covering those days?
Got it. So and to start with, they had about 70% of days.
70% of the days. Now that is below ideal. We consider good adherence above 0.8 by convention, and that's based on studies that show that that's where you begin to see more dramatic decreases in readmissions and relapses for individuals with schizophrenia. So by convention, 0.8 is considered a cutoff for medication possession ratio of good adherence. So they start out just below it, but you know, below it, they're around 0.72 or so. But that over time, the intervention group got closer to 8. So they went up to 0.78, while there was no change. They made around 0.7 for the control group.
That's really impressive. It really is.
Well, it was very exciting, and I think, you know, I think that they're modest differences, but they're differences that could really matter. So we're saying if someone's going to about 0.7 to quite close to a 0.8, that is that cutoff number that we're hoping to get above, and so that is a significant clinically meaningful change.
And it's clinically meaningful, and it also, well, one thing that I like about the paper is that you mention that Pat Deegan talks about the ethical imperative towards shared decision making, but you're also trying to put some evidence behind it to convince people to put in the resources that are needed to implement it. So it's showing something that is effective so that it should be put into practice, but it's also can serve as some evidence to get these things paid for.
Absolutely. I mean, that was a really important driver for this study, which is that when you're thinking about, you know, this is a tremendous program that has been developed, people want to know, you know, it actually won a gold award from the APA for implementation that was done. I mean, it's one of the things that when you see presented, it's impressive, and you want to think about, well, how do we disseminate this? How do we implement it more broadly? And what managed care companies or states or counties want to know is, okay, it looks looks interesting. What am I going to get out of it? Am I going to get better outcomes? Am I going to save any money? How much money is it going to cost me? You know, so in order for them to make those kinds of investments, they want to understand what are they going to get out of it. And this was one step.
So Molly, what would you say, we've talked about, I think we've alluded to the study strengths, and we've talked a little bit about the design limitations and I guess how you've been extremely clever in implementing this in a large system and the benefits of having your incredible backbone, your psyche's backbone. Are there other limitations to your study that the listeners should know about?
Nope, perfect study.
Yeah.
No,
I mean, if you could go back or if you could fix.
We did touch on some. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's not randomized, so there could be something. You know, there could be some difference about the person that says that they could use it, said that they would use it. And so one thing that brings up is, you know, in these clinics, if we had about, I don't have the statistic in front of me, but let's say like about 40 to 50% of the individuals used in these 12 clinics, you could say, well, maybe there's something special about the users. And that would be a reasonable assumption. You would say the secret bias here is that there's something about the person who says, yes, I will try this, that is different. But if you look at our data at the clinic level about the penetration of use, it's very uneven. And it doesn't seem to be as much about the clients as it does about clinic level factors. Hmm. So, for example, in some clinics, the penetration was 90%, and in other clinics, it might be quite low, you know, less than 20%.
How do you understand that?
Well, I think that there was another paper that we actually had recently published that looked at least our first two pilot sites and was really looking and trying to understand the differences in penetration based on the differences in implementation. And we were looking at what are those factors that seem to be associated with these kinds of differences. And one I think that was really important, you know, people will always say, of course, leadership is very important. So a clear leadership vision that this is our new way of doing business, this is what we're going to be all about, this is going to be part, you know, part of the way we do business in this clinic.
Were there doctor effects? Did you find that certain doctors were more?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And this is more anecdotal at this point, and I'm very interested to sort of follow up and try to dig into this a little bit about the site level effects, the clinician level effects versus client level effects, because I think people want to say it's the clients, but I, you know, our anecdotal sort of review of this is it's really the site and the physician are much more important, but we'd have to look at it a little bit more systematically. But for clinician effects, absolutely. You know, there's one doctor we spoke to at one of the clinics, and he said, you know, I had my doubts. I was kind of skeptical when I first started this. But then as the clients started doing it, they had a very strong workflow where you actually, you know, it was more like a medical office. You come in, you're in the waiting room, someone comes to get you, you do your common ground report, then you go to your appointment. So the doctor was getting the reports regularly and came to depend on them. And he's like, and then I really was relying on them. And so if someone came without one, I'd send them back. So it's sort of this interaction between, it can be that either coming from a physician or having a positive attitude about it, or in a place where physician may have been more ambivalent, but had the opportunity to get exposed over time, they have the opportunity to change their mind, you know, or to see the value.
Well, it's really a fascinating study and brings up a ton of different issues that we have touched on and are going to continue to touch on. And we're looking forward to reading and hearing about all the follow-up for some of these issues that you've brought up on the podcast today.
Okay. I want to just say, I think that the study is notable for implementing, in some sense, like a shared decision-making plus type of approach. It's not just shared decision-making tools. It's shared decision-making really supported by these different components, each of which could have contributed to the outcome. So as we've discussed, meeting with the peer, reviewing values and goals and clinical status before the appointment, and of course, the response of the clinician and the agency, all of those elements seem to, could very well have made an impact on the outcome of the intervention. And I just think to do it in the real world, in real time, in real clinics with basically unselected patients is very, very impressive. And I think it's really commendable.
Well, you know, thank you. And I, you know, it was not without having a great team and support behind me and collaboration with Pat Deegan and Pat Deegan Associates. And so I really appreciate what you're saying, that this is a multifaceted intervention, and it would be interesting to try and unpack what were the components that really were most important, both from the patient experience, you know, to get back to values of this work, but also in terms of impacting engagement and other outcomes of interest.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It was a fascinating conversation, and maybe we'll have you back someday.
Yeah. Oh, something tells me we'll hear again from Molly Finley. Well, that's it for today. We invite you to visit our website, ps.psychiatryonline.org, to read the article we discussed in this episode, as well as other great research. We also welcome your feedback. Please email us at psjournal@psych.org. You can also rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to it. And we would appreciate it if you like the podcast, share it with your friends.
So, rate and share.
Yes, rate and share.
Two steps, not complicated.
Right. I'm Lisa Dixon.
I'm Josh Berezin.
Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.